Once more under the breech, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And at this point, I'm supposed to tell you all kinds of totally uninteresting stuff, but I got to tell you anyway. It is that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Slido, Texas that is called the Personal Wealth Coach, which does wealth management stuff and investment advice and so on. And let's see, what else? The information we present on this radio program is information that we have gleaned from sources we believe to be reliable, and we've investigated and we're convinced are reliable, but we make no warranty as the accuracy or completeness of the information.
Don't you wish that would be said at every news outlet?
They ought to. The information that we present on here is educational. It's not considered investment advice. Investment advice is something you should receive as an individual considering your individual circumstances and conditions. There's something else in there we're supposed to say.
Yeah. The opinions that we express here are those of our own. What is our own? It is us.
There are opinions, yes.
They are our opinions and not the opinions of Town Square Media.
Yes. Does Town Square Media have opinions?
I don't know. It's an institution. Do institutions have opinions?
Well, according to the Supreme Court, they do.
They are people.
Yes, they can make political contributions.
Just to throw that in there, I want to make sure that people understand that I agree with that decision that corporations are people because it's been held for a very, 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 very long time that unions are people, which unions, just as a side note, are corporations.
They're also institutions.
Can I have an appropriate gasp of surprise there?
Gasp!
Yes, the unions are corporations. And so, of course, they're people. Who votes in a union? The shareholders vote in a union. So who votes in a corporation?
No, the members vote in a union.
Right.
The shareholders vote in.
They're members in the same sense that a limited liability company is a corporation as well. They're members. So owners, shareholders, members, co-op members, they're all built in the same kind of structure. So when the Supreme Court said corporations were people, I said, of course they are. What else? Papers don't vote by themselves. Anyway.
Well, the other thing I want to say here is that this is the last day of June, the 30th. And if it is the 30th of June, 2018, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call with your thoughts, questions, comments, or whatever, as long as it doesn't have anything to do with team sports or sports in general.
How about partisan politics?
I'd rather stay away from partisan politics, although
that's a team sport these days.
We are into economics and investing and markets, and unfortunately, at least in my opinion, partisan politics and the economy have overlapped a bit. So
a little too much for our comfort.
And so if it is June 30th, 2018, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400 with your thoughts, comments, or whatever. The market this week ended a quarter.
It ended a quarter?
Yes.
How do you end a quarter?
They did.
All my quarters are round.
Yeah, well, they have lots of ends on them.
Endless.
They have little bumps.
From certain directions.
They have little bumps all the way around them. Each one of those bumps is an end. Anyway.
So we're done with the second quarter.
Yes. Well, we're not done with the second quarter, but the market is because the market's closed on Friday. And
for us, it ends tonight. Yeah.
And for the quarter, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.7%. The S&P 500 was up 2.9%, and the NASDAQ was up 6.3%. Big difference between them. Normally, the S&P and the Dow are about the same, but there was an interesting switcheroo in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. They took GE out this week.
Yes.
And when they took GE,
I think it was last week, wasn't it?
Well, they announced it last week, and I think they did it this week. But when GE came out, it promptly rose quite a lot, and they replaced it by Walgreens Boots Pharmacy.
Boots?
B-O-O-T-S.
Yes.
Walgreens-Boots Pharmacy.
Imagine that. Walgreens is now bigger than General Electric.
Well, it was until it entered the Dow, and it promptly went down. But it didn't go down because it entered the Dow. It went down because of a very significant event that probably not a lot of people paid any attention to, but it's one of those really big things that we'll look back on and say, wow, that was a really big thing.
Right.
Amazon spent a few billion dollars buying a pharmaceutical delivery company.
Yep.
That puts all the pills you're going to take in a given day into a packet and gives you a month worth of the pills at a shot, but they're in packets where you just open up the packet during the day and you take the pills.
Right.
Rather than having to go through a whole series of bottles.
Each one of the bottles, open them up, pop them out. Yeah.
And Amazon.
Oh, the inconvenience.
Well, let me tell you, when you get my age, and my age is more than I like to think about, and you have 8 prescriptions and a bunch of non-prescriptions that the doctors told you to take, and you take them a couple of times a day, and you got to remember which ones are where and when, it is actually a challenge sometimes.
Well, I think it's a memory challenge. That's part of the prescription writing. It's so that you can work on your memory issues.
Could be, but the fact is it saves a lot of time, and the issue is that if we get a big pharmaceutical organization in the United States that can bargain with the companies that actually make the pills.
Which that requires a big enough company. Well, wait, Amazon's pretty big, isn't
it? Yes.
Wow.
This could have a profound effect on the pharmaceutical companies like Walgreens Boots.
There's another thing, and this is
pharmaceutical delivery companies.
I'm going to throw this in because this hasn't happened yet, but it fits right in with what you're talking about. Before we had a trade agreement with Canada, Canada didn't negotiate with the U.S. pharmaceutical companies to use their drugs. Are you aware of this?
Mm.
They just established, and it's still on the books, in the laws of Canada, the ability for the executive branch of Canada to give a stay of enforcement on patent law so that they can use the drugs themselves and make their own generics. Part of the free trade agreement that we signed with Canada was
NAFTA.
Well, before NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
So before it was
but
NAFTA.
It's in NAFTA, too.
It's in NAFTA as well. Was to say that you will respect our patent laws and buy things that we invent from us and not make a waiver for health benefit purposes. So since then, Canada has negotiated with U.S. companies for the pharmaceuticals. If NAFTA goes away, then expect the old patent waiver concept to come back, and they will simply start manufacturing the pills the way they used to.
Well, anyway, the Dow, that's one of the main reasons that the Dow didn't rise as much in the quarter as the S&P 500. Now, for the week, it is sort of interesting. The Dow was down 1.26%. Year-to-date, it's down 1.81%. The S&P 500 for the week was down 1.33%, down 1.67% year-to-date. So if we get another week next week like this week.
For the year, we'll be down.
We'll be down for the year. Now, what happened? Oh, it wasn't a big sell. There's been a sell-off going for the past several days. And when I say
July 1st is coming.
Yes.
Yeah.
But July 1st comes every year, and we don't
know. Yeah, it does. But the Canadians this year celebrate, every year they celebrate July 1st as their Independence Day. They're also celebrating this year as their response to our tariffs day.
Yeah, so what's happened is, and we mentioned this when we came back from a conference recently, that the economists had concluded that the trade war threats were just threats. They were just bluffs. And the traders had concluded that
the
and
traders,
said everything
yeah.
is going to be fine. It's now looking more and more like they aren't bluffs, that we will have a full-blown, full-fledged, devastating, possibly, trade war underway within a week. And mutual fund investors and traders and a lot of other people are busy pulling their money out of the market. As a matter of fact, at about 3 p.m. Eastern time, an hour before the market closed, the outflows from mutual funds, from ETFs and stocks, started in earnest yesterday. And pulled it down. Actually, the Dow and the S&P 500 were up early in the day because Nike reported exceptionally good earnings. We also, go ahead.
I'm just going to throw this in. I think the reaction that we saw this week in the market was a larger reaction for the imposing tariffs, the tariffs that are coming into place July 1st in Canada, and in India that's August 4th, and in China they're talking July 6th. Mexico's already imposed some. So this concept that it's not a bluff is the reason why people were selling. The specific tariffs that are going into place tomorrow and then a little under a week from now or a week from today from China and from Canada are on a relatively small amount mm-hmm. of our goods. But the fact that it's happening means that a lot of people who believed this was all a bluff have to say, well, if it was a bluff, the bluff has been called, and that means that we're really in a trade war. So it's the people that were believing the opposite of what the president said and the opposite of what all the other countries said, which is we're in a trade war. And a lot of people were saying, no, don't worry about it. It's not going to amount to anything. We're going to back out of this, or somebody else is going to cave. Well, nobody's backed out and nobody's caved, which means we are full, honest to goodness, in a trade war, which
yeah,
is terrifying to people that haven't been paying attention.
By the way, in the short term, you're going to see what appear to be some tremendous economic benefits from the trade war. And
yeah,
that is,
yeah, absolutely.
We had record exports in the second quarter, a surge of exports far beyond what we're capable of continuing.
Because we sold everything we possibly yeah. could that hadn't already been hit by the tariffs.
And a lot of particularly manufacturing exporters, manufacturing investment in plants and equipment and so on is down and has been dropping again because of potential tariffs.
Even though there's a lot of money on hand from the tax cut, it's not being spent on manufacturing increases because of the tariffs.
And also there's a specific tax advantage to investing in equipment and plants now that wasn't there before. And the new tax law, the thought at the time, at least when the White House announced it and when Congress passed it, was it would cause companies to invest more money and reinvest in their own business. But the tariffs have
normal circumstances, that would be the case. Yeah.
The tariffs apparently have not only offset that, they've turned it into a negative. The companies are not investing and because they don't know what the situation will be in the larger companies.
In fact, not only not investing, they're shutting down things that they've already invested in.
Mm. Yeah. So what we've got is you're going to see probably an amazingly high GDP number for the second quarter. And it's important to recognize that there's a couple of things there. The majority of our economy is consumer spending. All the indicators, we don't have the final numbers yet for the end of the quarter because it's not officially over until tonight at midnight, but we're seeing that consumer spending has been trending downward. In other words, the acceleration, the growth in consumer spending, it isn't like that people are spending less money. It's just that the consumer spending level of growth that we saw last year and even in the first quarter is reversing itself this quarter. And again, there's some pretty good reasons for that. Our savings rate is going up. Pretty good reasons for that. Exports, though, are going to surge, and that's going to cause the GDP to rise. But either this quarter or the next quarter, unless something major changes, are going to be the high GDPs that you see. And from there on, everything we're looking at right now says we will trend downward. Now, let me add a little little.
There are
let
reasons
me add a
why
little
that
addendum
wouldn't,
here.
Yeah, that
Well, let me add a little addendum here. The GDP in the first quarter grew at a 2.3% rate, except that was the second estimate. The third estimate, which just now came out this week, reduced that to 2%, and they reduced it to 2% because they realized consumers had not spent as much as they thought. So we're starting to see the main engine that drives the United States economy begin to slow down. And why is it slowing down? Well, wages haven't gone up very much. And just to give you a hint, the price of washing machines, and we've often talked about consumer durables being
right.
a big piece of what people spend money on.
It's a leading economic indicator when somebody's
right.
ordering durable goods that you're going to use more than 5 years.
And washing machines are up 20. The price in washing machines, because of the tariffs,
because that was the first tariff that
right.
went into place,
are now up 20%. And people are looking at the washing machines and saying, No, that's a little, that they were less expensive in the past. I'm not going to buy one.
Yeah, so I'll wait a while. I've waited 6 years to buy one. I can wait some more. My washing machine's not broken. I'll just keep going. Throw that into the middle. Hold on to that thought. Hold on to it really well because prices are up. At the same time that's going on, prices are going up in dishwashers. So this is another durable good order. And that's because of steel and aluminum. So hold that in. The tariffs are there. People are saying prices going up. People aren't saying this. They just see prices going up and they say, I don't want to buy that right now. On top of that, the Energy Department over the years has instituted a whole series of regulations on dishwashers and on washing machines. If you recall back 15 years ago, when you put a load in your dishwasher and you turned it on, it made a lot of noise. Do you remember this? All the swishing noises. It wasn't like a mechanical sound. It was just a lot of swishing noises. And then the entire cycle lasted maybe half an hour. Have you tried to sit around while your dishwasher is washing dishes lately? It's going to be about 2 hours, and it's not going to be as clean as it was 15 years ago. And it's because the Energy Department did the same thing with dishwashers and with washing machines as they did with toilets. If you recall that, you know, make the all manufactured toilets have to have a certain gallon per moment flush cycle. And so for a while there, it made it really difficult to do your duty in the toilet
without...
You just
flushed multiple times.
Right. And then eventually, somebody came up with a better design for the toilet that would allow one flush to get it out with less water. That was kind of the intent. That was the hope. It happened. In the case of dishwashers, it didn't happen. In the case of washing machines, it did. But only one company was able to really get it down right, and that happens to be a South Korean company. So that's who we slapped a tariff on. So the reality is that we currently have two things that are affecting from completely different sides of the political spectrum that are affecting the sales of durable goods. You've got the Department of Energy that was a very Democratic idea. The Democrats put that in place and said, well, we're going to save some water. Even though you might have to run your dishwasher four times to get it clean, that doesn't save water. And at the same time, we're going to raise prices on that because of the tariffs. So that's from the Republican side. And the reality is the consumers at home going, now I have dirty dishes that cost me a lot to stay dirty. Probably not the best methodology for making decisions.
Well,
it's the way it is the best. It is absolutely the best methodology to make decisions except for all the other ones.
Okay.
So that's democracy for you.
But the nice thing about the change in dishwashers, and nice or not nice as the case may be, is that they removed a lot of phosphates from the dishwashing detergent, which made them less efficient.
Right.
But in removing the phosphates from the dishwashing detergent, hopefully we can...
We may actually live longer and our water will be cleaner.
Yeah, well, there's a big dead zone off the mouth of the Mississippi where there just aren't any fish. Because large quantity of phosphates from fertilizers and previously from dishwashing detergent were in the water, and they basically, make a long story short, suck up all the oxygen. So I don't know if this is bad.
It's not bad.
My dishwasher is now really quiet.
Yeah, mine is too. I actually like my dishwasher.
Turn it on when I go to bed and get up in the morning, and it doesn't make loud noises, so it doesn't wake me up at night.
We have to be careful about trash-talking our dishwashers because these days they can be connected to the internet and be listening to a live stream of us talking, and they might get upset and not do the dishes quite right.
We have found out how to get jobs in the supply chain repatriated to the United States.
How is that?
It's happened in Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker announced it, and the president was really excited about it. Foxconn.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Built a big factory to make flat panel LCDs in Wisconsin.
Wait a minute. They're making them in the United States again?
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
And this is, you know, they're going to, they it, the plant will be larger than the Pentagon. It'll be a huge building.
That's a big plant. It takes a lot of watering to
and
get
initially,
a plant that big.
Initially will employ 3,000 people.
Wait a minute. That's a lot less than are employed at the Pentagon.
Yeah. Well, eventually they plan to
How many people is the eventual number for people employed there?
Well, 10,000.
Okay.
Maybe.
It depends on
There's
automation.
No guarantee. But the point, the interesting point is they're coming in most 10,000 is if everything works out fine and the economy is going like gangbusters, but that's a promise. Now, this is the interesting point. If they employ 10,000 people.
Uh-huh. That's still a lot less than they're employed at the Pentagon.
Then the grants and tax breaks from Wisconsin and from the United States government to Foxconn that encouraged them to build the plant there.
Uh-huh.
We'll be purchasing those jobs at $1 million per job.
Oh, wow. I'll work there for that.
So what happens is the wages there are going to average $53,900 a year. And the grants so far to Foxconn to build the plant.
Government grants.
The government grants, which means that it comes out of our tax money. It comes out of Wisconsin's tax money and federal money. It's pretty huge. Basically, for $1 million, we can get, if they employ all 10,000 workers now, if they only employ 3,000, it's $3 million, $3.3 million per worker. If we pay a company $1 million per worker, they will hire a worker at $54,000 a year.
Wow. And they'll do it all day long.
Yeah.
With
no guarantee on how long they'll keep them employed. So we now know what it costs to get a foreign... What used to be manufactured in the United States has now moved to, in this case, Taiwan, and get them to come back to the United States. All we need is to pay the foreign company or the company in. Hey, I'll bet if the president offered to pay Harley-Davidson
$1 million an employee,
$1 million per employee to make,
they wouldn't move a plant to Thailand.
No,
I will tell you that.
No, that would work really, really well, but. In fact, we're paying it to Foxconn, which there's a certain irony here, folks. The irony is that $1 million goes to China per worker because it's a Chinese company. Yeah, it's a Taiwanese-Chinese company, but they have – so Foxconn makes much of this – the majority of their manufacturing, by the way, is in mainland China, not in Taiwan. I think it's sort of interesting that if we pay China $1 million a worker, we can get more workers in the United States.
Yeah, I think people can hear that we have our tongue in our cheek very firmly now, but this is a real situation. We find it humorous. The effort to maintain businesses in the United States is not concerted. It's not unified. It is made by its decision makers all over the country, and some of them make good decisions. Most of them don't. So we have situations like this where that's probably going to be long-term really detrimental to Wisconsin, but it looks good this year.
I don't, you know, one of the things in I think it was in Barron's that I was reading this, The financial analysis on this is, since Foxconn is not going to pay any taxes on the property,
how can Wisconsin ever get its money back?
Well,
for
theoretically,
all those grants?
Theoretically, they get it back because of the increased economic activity in the area because of employing 3,000 people
right.
And later 10,000 people.
The
analysis that I read said they couldn't figure out how, given from now to infinity, if they employed 10,000 people, Wisconsin would ever get its money back.
Right. There was an all-you-can-eat restaurant in China that got started. It lasted a week because they had this great idea. They said, we're going to give grants to the customers. We're going to give them a card. They buy it for $25, and they can have all they can eat all month long. So $25.
I would buy that.
A lot of people did.
Yes.
And put the business completely out of business in the first week.
Why did they price it at $25?
Because they thought it was a nice gimmick and that they would have a slow inflow of people that would buy, that would eat reasonable amounts of food, and that only one person would hold the card and not hand it to their family. And unfortunately for them, they found something true in human nature. If you give a competitive challenge to people, all you can eat for $25, they'll take you up on it because you've just told them.
Per meal, I could see that might work.
Yeah, for a month, doesn't work. So they wound up being in a lot of debt at the end of the first week and having to shut the doors. And because people were handing the card on to other family members and...
And then they got sued for
eating
false
there
promises.
Five or six times a day. No, this was in China, so they don't have the lawsuit concept going.
Hey,
so
coming out
there.
With a completely different subject. There are people who disagree with us in our forecast.
No!
That the fiscal, which is what the government does with money, fiscal policies that have gone into effect this year, and it's a combination of the tax cuts, increased spending by the government, and the tariffs, probably, there's no certainty about the future, probably will lead to a recession around 2020 and great economic unhappiness. And people have said, no, you guys don't know what you're talking about. And it's
that,
all part of a
maybe
grand,
true.
It's possible. They say, people have said it's all part of a grand strategy and it's all, and look, everything is coming up roses and it's going to be wonderful. We made another prediction recently. As a matter of fact, December, we made a prediction that Bitcoin was going to have a sell-off and it was going to rival anything that we've ever seen or worse than anything we've ever seen in the stock market.
Let's tell a little bit more about the prediction and how we made it. So we made it on the air throughout the end of 2017, but we didn't stop there. I made this prediction to one of the leaders in blockchain technology. I made this prediction to head executives at IBM. And they listened very rapidly, and they have sent me back messages of appreciation since then. So I said to them, this was unsustainable, that expect to see at least a 50% drop in the near future.
Well, you were too pessimistic.
I was too pessimistic. It was a lot more than 50% drop, 67% drop.
You may recall that at the end of December, Bitcoin, we do have a call coming in on 773-1400. One moment, we'll be with you. You may recall that at Bitcoin at the end of December was trading at about $18,000 per coin, and it was a great frenzy, and we received a lot of calls from people say, shouldn't I be investing in Bitcoin? Bitcoin was down to $5,800 this week.
From $20,000.
Right at
19.
That was 18,000.
Yeah, 18,887. So I rounded up a little high.
And it has been, and it is sliding steadily downward with each passing week. And at some point, I strongly suspect there will be a panicked rush for the exit. There are now several of the other cryptocurrencies that have come out whose value is now zero, nada, worthless.
Zero, nada, worthless.
All of those things.
Yes.
And
at the same time.
Yes. But we do have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I have a two-part question to ask you. The one is, why is it that banks can just insure you for so much money before they can't guarantee any benefits on your money? And the next question is, if a bank's franchise been named, for an example, First State Bank for years and years and years, and then all of a sudden it changes its name, what's the behind-scenes activities going on that issue?
All right.
Good day, sir.
Appreciate the call. Good call.
Good questions.
All right. Do you want to hit the FDIC and I'll hit the purchase of the bank?
Used to be, I could go all the way back when the FDIC insurance was what we would consider to be an insignificant amount. Insured up to $10,000 by the FDIC. I remember when it was below $10,000.
It was a significant amount at the time, though.
And
you
today,
could buy a house with it.
Right. Today, the FDIC, which is the Federal Depository Insurance Corporation, insures an account in a member bank that says FDIC, member FDIC on the door, for up to $250,000. And that's because that's what the law authorizes them to do. And it's backed by implicit, if not statutory, authority of the United States Congress that they will step in as they have in the past, even if the FDIC goes broke.
Okay, yeah.
So that's why it's limited to $250,000. Now, as the benefits, they don't guarantee any benefits. They just guarantee you get your money back.
Yeah, the FDIC is something that came out following the Great Depression.
During the Great Depression.
During the Great Depression, following a lot of the bank failures of the Great Depression.
Right after the holiday.
Yeah, it's a bank holiday.
Right.
It's really a really, really nice, long bank holiday.
It was only about a week. Shut all the banks down for 1 week, by the way, in the United States in the 1934, I think.
Yeah.
All the banks just basically shut their doors for a week.
The reason was because people were coming and taking all their money out. And something that most people need to realize is that at the bank itself, they don't have enough cash, even back then when cash was a larger percentage of the money supply than it is today. They didn't have the cash on hand. If you showed up and said, hey, give me all the cash, they wouldn't have enough. So they'd have to shut the doors. Enough of that was going on, panics across the nation, that all the banks shut down. And Congress said, well, we got to do something about that. So there is an insurance company. The FDIC is an insurance company. It's sort of a quasi-private public thing. It's part private company, part public company, and it's an insurance company, and it is paid by the banks. Every month they pay a premium to FDIC for your coverage, basically, so that you will feel safe putting money in the bank.
I want to correct my previous statement. It was
1933. 33. We missed it by a year.
But it was only 3 days.
It was the end of 33. It was in December because this was the Christmas issue.
Yeah, and they basically shut the banks down for 3 days for a cooling off period, as they called it, to in effect. And the president did that. So it was an interesting experience. And if you can imagine today, all of a sudden your credit card stopped working for 3 days. That's how bad it got in 1933.
All right, so First State Bank is a local bank. It's a bank that's been here for a long time. It's a great bank. They've got good relationships with people. There's nothing wrong with that bank. It's been in talks with Bancorp South, which is a larger bank, and it's got branches all over the south of the United States. They're based out of Georgia, I believe. Banks have been talking about merging, buying for about 5 years, maybe a little bit longer than that now, the preliminary talks. And it had a lot of slow-ups, a lot of regulatory oversight, and the Federal Reserve was looking and saying, you got to pass these stress tests. And then the Obama administration was saying, you've got to pass these ownership tests. And the Obama administration came back again and said, now you've got to pass these transfer assets tests. And now so it was a very long process. But Bancorp South has been buying, in the act of buying, First State Bank for half a decade. It's finally finished the purchase. The vast majority of the employees are the same employees at First State Bank as they are at Bancorp South now in the local, the ones that used to be First State Bank. And that's what happened there. What happens is that banks are companies, just like any other company. And if you've got a carpentry company or carpentry is a good one. You got a carpentry company or a funeral home company. You got a funeral home company. It's a local company. They've, since their founding, put up branches in the surrounding towns until they have 50 or 60 branches. They've become a pretty significant item. And the owners of that company say, well, I don't want to stay managing and owning this company forever. I'd like to take my profits. Who is willing to buy this company from me? And that's what happened with the bank. The bank came in, another bank came in and said, I'll buy that from you, and I'll buy it at a rate that you'll agree to and all the other owners will agree to. What Bancorp South has said is that they're going to preserve the local service mentality mm-hmm. and make sure that people still have good relationships and all that stuff. But that's a normal part of any
big purchase. It's just a simple issue of a Mississippi bank buying a chunk of Texas.
Mississippi, not Alabama. You're correct.
Yeah. Tupelo, Mississippi.
Tupelo, Mississippi. Tupelo. And I should know that. I should have remembered that.
You should have?
What am I doing mixing up states that are bordering each other in the South?
It's one of those states.
It is Mississippi So Bancorp South purchased First State Bank.
I get Louisiana and Mississippi mixed up because the Mississippi River doesn't run through Mississippi. It runs through Louisiana.
Right, which is very strange.
It is. It is very strange. So the telephone number in here, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number in here is 254 773-1400, and I think we have some commercials we need to play.
We do. Good timing.
Coming up on 20 minutes before the hour. So
perfect time. We'll play the commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in and join the conversation, 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And that's, by the way, why he keeps me around, is I have this superb radio voice, and I know how to say this and get our voices synchronized. But we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. This week in the Wall Street, they had an article. Apparently, the Fed is changing the way they stress test banks, and I know the Great Recession is in the rearview mirror. Are we getting complacent again, or is this a good thing? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I can take
good
that
call.
One.
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, banks domiciled in the United States, all of them passed the stress test with flying colors. Now, there's a couple of them.
Now, this is the old version of the stress test. So.
It's not a matter of complacency. They basically said if we had as severe a crunch as we had in 2008 and 2009, would you guys be able to continue to make loans and do your business? And they all passed in the United States. Now, Deutsche Bank's U.S. branch didn't, but there are a couple of Goldman Sachs and I think Morgan Stanley. There's a couple of banks that are out there that that they said no, you cannot increase your dividend payouts because
right. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs
because you passed, but you passed with kind of like a D minus. Now that's an important thing to look at. The U.S. operations of Deutsche Bank did not fully pass. They partially passed the stress test. They passed it, per se, but as far as transferring money out or giving out dividends, they can't do it. The Federal Reserve said, no, you cannot send a bunch of money to your home bank in Germany where they're really hurting
right.
because you don't have enough money. You don't have excess money here.
And they just okayed Citibank to give back $22 billion mm-hmm. as dividends to its shareholders. But that's because they have enough reserves on hand.
Yeah, but
so Deutsche Bank doesn't have enough reserves to be sending back the dividends, which are really going to be used to shore up a bank that's having a lot of trouble back home.
Yep. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. You brought up the subject of bitcoins, and I saw an article in the Temple paper this morning that's got me kind of confused, but I've never understood bitcoins anyway.
Nobody does.
And I don't understand how you can take a $5,000 Bitcoin and buy a $49.95 product off of Amazon or whatever store takes them. But mm-hmm. at any rate, the question I have, and I'm going to hang up when I get through with the question and just listen. But the question I have is that they said that there are hackers who are using individuals' computer power to mine Bitcoins or cryptocurrency. My understanding is that by mining, they mean creating cryptocurrency.
Right, right.
But how do they do that? How do you create cryptocurrency, and what the heck is it, and how do you use it?
All right, sounds like a question for me.
Yeah, well, let me answer the question about. Thank you for the call, by the way. I want to answer the first question about how hackers are using your computers. I got two emails today from people that I know that weren't from people I know. It came from their email address. It came from their computer. And it was simple. It was simple advertisements for really cruddy things. But a lot of people do not run a full antivirus internet security suite on their computer. And they allow the computer to be access the internet. If you don't have, for instance, presuming you have a Windows computer, I'm going to start with the fact that you have a Windows computer, Microsoft Windows running computer.
Yeah, Windows Defender should be running in the background if it's Windows 10.
If you've got Windows Defender running in the background and you've got the most recent version of Windows and you allow the laboriously long updates to take place, then your computer is probably in pretty good shape. If you have an older version of Windows, you need to have a very expensive software suite running in there, or there's a pretty good probability that somebody is illicitly using your computer anytime that it is online because you haven't protected it.
Right. Now, to get to the second question, I'm going to do my best to make this simplified. In order to understand cryptocurrency, you first have to understand blockchain. Blockchain is actually a fairly simple thing to understand. If you think of a normal ledger book, all blockchain is a ledger book. It's a ledger book that everybody can see. It's called a distributed ledger book. It means everybody can look at it and see if a transaction actually took place. They can't see who did it. They can just see an account number associated with it. So if a bank is trying to cash a check, they can see that the money was actually at the other place before they cash it, so it doesn't bounce. That's cool. It's a way of doing a ledger book. The last big update to ledger books took place in the early Renaissance when we started using double-entry bookkeeping, which everybody probably is familiar with and got bored to tears with when they learned about it. Some of us actually continue to use it. It's a very good method of keeping a ledger because you can see where the debits are and you can see where the credits are. The first bank company that started using double-entry bookkeeping wasn't actually a company. It was a family, the Medicis, and they basically funded the artistic and scientific revolution of the Renaissance based on the fact that they had a better way of calculating how much money they had on hand. A ledger book. That's it. So blockchain is the next update to the ledger book. It's not double entry. It's everybody can see double entry. So we went from one column and Roman numerals to big update from Roman numerals. Hey, it's a lot easier to do math if we use these new Arab numerals or Indian numerals, depending on who you believe came up with it. Okay, that's a big leap forward. That was what propelled us out of the Dark Ages. We could really figure out what we had on hand. Then we move forward and we get double entry. Now we have blockchain, which is a distributed ledger book. But we need to make sure that this ledger is encrypted. Okay, if you have a private blockchain, like a company or a group of companies, say, in all of our transactions, we're just going to encrypt this. There's no cryptocurrency involved at all. They're just encrypting the ledger books, just like anybody else would. If you were holding your bank's ledger book online, you're going to have it encrypted. That's what the little lock is that says secure when you log into a bank account online. Cryptocurrency comes when you don't have a bank company or you don't have any central authority saying this is my ledger book. Cryptocurrency comes when you have a peer-to-peer network that doesn't have a major authority involved. So everybody has as much authority as everybody else. So who's in charge of encrypting the data? That's the big question. If there's no company that says I'll encrypt that for you, then somebody's got to do it. So they've made a really complicated puzzle out of encrypting things. It's not a necessary puzzle. It's a puzzle that they made to encourage people to take part in the system more than anything else. It's basically granting a token if you solve a puzzle. And then you can use that token to buy things. So imagine Chuck E. Cheese. When you show up at Chuck E. Cheese, if that place is still around, it's been through so many different bankruptcies.
I actually have seen a Chuck E. Cheese.
They still exist. You go in, you give them money, they give you coins that are not money. They're tokens. They're tokens that you can only use at Chuck E. Cheese because you then go and you stick a token. Or you can consider a casino the same way because they give you a card with credits on it. That's not money. It's credits. You take a token, you play a game, you roll the ball up and it goes in the right hole and it spits out tickets. You can only use those tickets in the Chuck E. Cheese to buy the toys there. Okay. Or you can trade it with other people that go to Chuck E. Cheese that want to buy toys. Now, Chuck E. Cheese makes a profit on the round trip there, a pretty significant one. There's not a Chuck E. Cheese involved in the puzzle making. This group got together and said, what we're going to do to make sure that we keep this encrypted, I realize it'd be easy just to encrypt it, but what we're going to do is we're going to make a complicated puzzle. The person that solves the puzzle for each page of the ledger book, each block of the blockchain, gets some tokens. Who's to say that those tokens are worth anything is only the people that use those tokens. So if somebody comes online and says, I'm going to buy that token for $5,000, then suddenly that token is worth $5,000. It's just like a trading card at that point. Who says a Mickey Mantle card is worth anything more than the paper it's printed on? Well, supply and demand. So the people that are using Bitcoins say, this is great. It's going to be our currency into the future. You brought up, caller, a point where how are you going to buy something that costs $49.99 using a Bitcoin that's worth in excess of many thousands of dollars? Well, you can break the Bitcoin. You can do fractional percentages of the Bitcoin, just like pennies to a dollar. It can be broken down. Go ahead.
But the fact is, Bitcoin never took off and is very rarely used by anyone other than North Korea and drug dealers money.
Yeah, let me say why that is, because that's the next point I was going to make here, and you're absolutely right. It never took off because they couldn't decide on the value of the Bitcoin. The volatility of the Bitcoin, people buying and selling Bitcoins like crazy, making it go up 40% in a day or down 40% in a day, means that you couldn't figure out how much money you had in your hand when you were going to buy something. That's why it never took off. You can't use a currency that you don't know the value of at any given moment. When you take a dollar out of your pocket, you're pretty sure that the price tag in the store is going to be in dollars. And that it's not going to be changing as you're paying for it. That's not true in Venezuela right now. Their prices change as you buy things because they've got runaway inflation. So cryptocurrencies are prizes for solving puzzles. And the prizes may or may not have value. It just has value if enough people want the prize.
I know we got a call, but gold is another. Bitcoin is just gold on steroids, in effect. Gold, for example, for the quarter was down 6.02%. Now,
right. People
want to go to the gold standard and use gold as the basis for money. If you knew in advance, at the beginning of the quarter, that your gold money, your money that's made out of gold, was going to drop 6% in the quarter,
you probably wouldn't want to be on the gold standard.
But that was our money. People would be rushing out and spending their money, which would cause a collapse in gold prices.
Right.
Would go down much faster. Being on the gold standard doesn't work unless you can lock in by law the price of gold, which we
did.
That's what the Bretton Woods Agreement
was. Right, that's how the gold standard worked, is just like Chuck E. Cheese locks in this is how many tokens it takes to play a given game.
Yeah.
They're fixing a price to give value to their tokens.
And the Federal Reserve, in essence, fixes a price for the dollar. But we have a caller on 773-1400. We're running out of time for the hour, but you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
This is really quick, has nothing to do with Bitcoins. You talked about dishwashers, and one of you guys said you had a dishwasher and you loved it. I need to replace my dishwasher, which is me right now, with another dishwasher. What was the brand? What's the style? Let it off. Give us information.
Send me an email and I'll send you it, because I don't have it memorized.
I very frankly, I can tell you where we got ours, and I'm completely silent. You can't even tell the darn thing is running. And
You turned it on?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I turned it on in the evening, and we don't even notice it's on. And we got it at Sears.
Right. I've got a Samsung, but I'm not sure the model.
Yeah.
So if you give us an email and tell you the ones. There's good quality dishwashers out there. Just don't get the lowest priced one or you're going to be washing.
I know this is absolutely counterintuitive, but I went to the local Sears store in Temple. It's not a very big store, by the way. It's a little bitty store, and it's mostly got dishwashers and washing machines in it. And we got it there, and I said, which one is the most quiet? And he pointed at one of them and said, this is the one. It's got these special drawers.
This one doesn't say anything at all. It's just been sitting there all day.
And the thing is, this is an interesting thing. I went to Sears because they actually had a person who knew the dishwashers and knew what they did and would talk to us about the dishwashers, as opposed to going to Lowe's or Home Depot or Best Buy or someplace.
They attempt to do it there, but it's not always the case.
And so there is an economic lesson right there. People, and we certainly depend on that at the Personal Wealth Coach, that's why it's called personal. People want personal service from somebody who knows what they're talking about. and that's the kind of people we want to do business with. There's not a lot of them because Sears has a little tiny store, and right. Lowe's and Home Depot and Best Buy have huge stores with lots of dishwashers.
People are buying their dishwashers on Amazon now. I mean, refrigerators and dishwashers are being delivered.
And they go down and look at the reviews to determine what they're going
right.
to buy.
And that's how they do it. Or they'll ask a question there or check through the questions that are already on there. Hey, how well does this do the dishes? But that means that you've got to do all the research yourself rather than ask somebody who's already done it. Hopefully they've done it.
As a passing closing comment, I think the purchase of whatever pill grabber or whatever it is by Amazon is going to be one of the biggest things that PillPack is we're going to look back and say that was a major shift in the economy because as much as I love my local pharmacist and I do, and we'll probably continue to use them indefinitely, it's still a very inefficient system where they package the pills up by hand in little bottles and hand you a packet full of little bottles and so on. And, that is going to be a big thing when you can order your pharmaceutical needs en masse from Amazon. And we're out of time for this hour. You have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach for the first hour. We got another hour coming up. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do manage money for higher net worth people. And we are available at 254-947-1111, voicemail on the weekends, live people during the week.
Or you can reach that number toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and read all about us. Until next hour.